Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the regularly scheduled podcasts after E3 and all the live reaction podcasts we did. It's good to get back to the regular format when we're not all absolutely exhausted from getting up at the most ridiculous times of day to watch them. So, yeah, obviously this week in the podcast, we'll be talking a lot about E3. We'll be catching up on Nintendo, which we didn't do a podcast about during the week. And we've certainly got a lot to talk about there. And we've also got Final Fantasy XIV expansion to talk about, which is cool because there's a new one and there's a lot of stuff in that content. Yeah, that was just a really bad line, but there's a lot of content in that stuff, and content is good, as we keep being told all through E3. So yeah, we'll be talking about that content. This week with me, we have a couple of Final Fantasy XIV fans, because that would make sense. We've got Ginny. Hello, Ginny.
Hey, Matt.
We have Other Matt. Hello, Other Matt.
Hello, Other Matt.
This could go on all day.
And everyone else, of course.
And we also have with us somebody who's not a Final Fantasy XIV fan, but is a fan of Nintendo and absolutely insisted on jumping on to talk about Rabbids and stuff. Hello, Trent. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Cool bananas. Okay, so we might just have a bit of Hatsune Miku music to get everyone in the mood for good stuff, and then we'll get on with the podcast.
Oh,
And welcome back. That was our customary Hatsune Miku track, only this week it was a little bit different. The other voices that you would have heard in that track was Bump of Chicken. Bump of Chicken is a very popular indie rock band in Japan, and they did a collaboration with Miku for that song, which is actually one of the most popular ones. So yeah, really, really cool little song. Good bit of trivia for you. A little bit different, I guess, to the usual Miku stuff. Okay, so E3 happened, and we're all recovering from it. We were all here in Australia and New Zealand watching along, and that meant some very early starts to the morning. Thank goodness Microsoft at least had the good sense not to put their show on at 2 o'clock in the morning, as they've done in years past. But EA was still at a ridiculous hour, Nintendo was at a ridiculous hour, so yeah, we're all a little bit sleep deprived, which is why you might hear me tripping over my tongue more than a couple of times this podcast. I apologize for that. But yeah, everybody watched a lot of stuff. We've written a lot of stories for the DDNet website. And what did everyone think of the show?
I think there was a lot of mediocrity, a lot of predictable approaches to franchises that no one really needed more games for. Very few new IPs. I think less than last year, I believe, or at least it feels like there were less new IPs than last year. Maybe because the new IPs that did come out this year were just so generic. I mean, I know everyone, you know, it's going to hop on BioWare's metaphorical a game appendage. But Anthem just looked really, really boring.
It really did.
I was actually quite surprised that one of the ones that I actually liked more was Microsoft. In the past, Microsoft has not been my favorite presser. But, I mean, I guess the bar was set really low initially this year. Sorry to EA, but I think surprisingly Microsoft and Nintendo, no surprises there, one of my favorites. And I think a shadow contender, like a dark horse for me really, was Ubisoft, because I spend so much time shit talking Ubisoft. Like honestly, like every FPS that comes out, I spend like at least like one review shitting on it. So I was really surprised that I actually quite liked what was going on this time. And I think it all really came down to presentation. Like the way that they were received really differed, because some people just lost the plot when it came to presenting the titles. Like I feel like the presses that had way less influences actually sold the product much better, and it was a lot more meaningful and it felt a lot more engaging. And so that also contributed to how I would rank the different presses.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a pretty fair assessment of what happened overall. I mean, there was some good stuff that was happening backstage. You know, we talk a lot about what happens in the shows, but on the floor itself, you had Calypso come out and show off some really good looking simulation games. They weren't on stage, but you know, Tropico 6 looks really great, and Railway, whatever it's called, Railway Manager, Railway Tycoon. They got a Railway Tycoon game coming out anyway, and it looks just great. And Dungeon 3 looked really good. They had a really good show for, you know, a mid-tier publisher. Sega had a really good show with two Yakuza games to show off and get us all very excited for. And, you know, Sega's subsidiary was Atlus. It is Atlus, and Atlus had that Vanillaware game, which looks just breathtaking. What's it called? 13 Sentinels? That stuff was there. And then obviously this year was perhaps a little bit unusual in that a lot of publishers and developers decided to make their big three E3 announcements in the 2 weeks leading up to E3, perhaps because they didn't want to be overshadowed by, you know, all the big blockbuster stuff that was happening. And, you know, Koei wasn't at E3 at all, but they had some pretty big announcements to make, you know, in the lead up to E3. So, yeah, aside from Ubisoft, I found the presentations to be pretty dull. Matt, what did you think? I mean, did you enjoy the show?
Well, I wasn't there, obviously, so I can only talk really about the press conferences, which were mostly kind of a bit bland. But you were talking before about a lot of the publishers doing their announcements before because they didn't want to be overshadowed by the big first parties, and I was just laughing at the notion of something like 13 Sentinels being overshadowed by something like Days Gone or whatever it's called.
Yeah, Days Gone.
Yeah, I thought it was most of the press conferences were aside from Ubisoft, which was uncharacteristically very good. I thought they were all just a bit boring, and yeah, the most interesting things from E3 are what I heard about through things like Twitter or the stuff that was actually on the show floor that didn't really get much coverage. Like, it seems like there was a lot of cool indie stuff there. And yeah, but I don't know. I think it's further and further getting away from this being like the major showpiece event, and it's been going that way for a few years, I think. But
you've got Gamescom, which is obviously a big deal these days for Western publishers as well, and they didn't generally put a lot of effort into that. The Japanese developers and publishers are swinging back towards, you know, Tokyo Game Show being something where they make big reveals, especially Sony. Sony's obviously got the Western business, which it shows off at E3, but then it's got a lot of Japanese games, which it only really stage at TGS. So, yeah, I think E3's relevance as a major industry event in which we find out all the stuff that we'll be playing for the next year is on its way out. I mean, you can also, I guess, look at the way that this year was running, that it was the first E3 that was open to the public. It's becoming more and more a way of marketing games that are kind of in the immediate now or the really huge blockbuster stuff rather than an industry conference, which is what it used to be. Now, I know we're going to talk about Nintendo specifically in the next segment because there's a lot of talk about there, but aside from Nintendo, as a big Nintendo fan, Trent, what did you think of the rest of the show? Was there anything there that, you know, whet your appetite for Sony or Microsoft?
I think we're forgetting the winner of the whole show. It's Devolver Digital's press conference. That was clearly the clearly the outline and clearly the best show out of all of them. I know, Matt, you were watching a bit of it, were you?
Yeah, it was performance art, I think, is the best way to describe that one. It was something special, that's for sure. I don't know how much value it was as information about games, but yeah, as a bit of theatre, it was a lot of fun.
I know there was no reveals during that, but there were stuff during the pre-show, as in just going over a few of their content, which they've got output as a publisher. So there were games shown off during the pre-show, but most of it was just, as you said, performance art throughout it. I think the other winner would obviously be Ubisoft. They did have a definitely a strong show this year. A lot of the games there we were discussing during the E3 podcast that, you know, we all enjoyed, we all wanted, and definitely would be all purchasing or getting in some way, shape or form down the track. So it looks like they were a solid performer, especially Microsoft as well was another solid performer, and Nintendo, of course. But you said I should talk about Nintendo, so I'm putting my hands up there.
What about you, Matt?
Oh, me? I have thoughts.
Really? That's not like you at all.
Yeah. No, I was just really disappointed with Sony. Really, really disappointed with Sony, to be honest. Yeah, that's the one that I've been looking forward to in the last couple of years to kind of, you know, really get me excited about the stuff that was at E3. And Sony didn't really have any of that. And then even, you know, backstage, in the pre-event and stuff, they had a couple of bits and pieces that were of interest, but you know, there's just too much crap like God of War and Good Days Gone and stuff that just won't ever appeal to me. Then yeah, I found Ubisoft to be the best of the lot as well. You know, there were surprises there that I wasn't expecting. Skull and Bones was, you know, really something that I think I'll really enjoy, even though it is a multiplayer-focused game, and that's not usually for me. This one, you know, pirate ships, and just the fact that it's been developed by a different studio within Ubisoft, as Ubisoft Singapore. It's the first time they've led a game, I believe. It's something to get my attention, and hopefully it delivers on what it's promising. I didn't watch the EA conference live because I was asleep. But when I got up to, when I tried to catch up and I started to watch it again, it put me back to sleep. So that kind of explains, you know, what I think of EA's efforts or lack thereof this year. Microsoft was great. Microsoft was really great. But all the stuff that Microsoft was great at doing, I'll just be playing on my PlayStation. Like I said in a tweet, after Sony's thing, I think Microsoft did a better job of selling the games I'll be playing on my PlayStation than Sony did this year. So I don't know if that was quite what Microsoft intended on doing. But yeah, that's the, I guess, the summary of the event. Like I said at the start of the podcast, for me, the really interesting stuff was the stuff that I was seeing via trailers and stuff back, you know, from the stage floor. Sega was great and Calypso was great. So.
We'll
And welcome back. So, Nintendo specifically, we didn't talk about Nintendo in a podcast through the event. You can listen to all the other podcasts of our live reactions to each of the events on our site. But yeah, we didn't have enough people awake at that time of morning to really talk about Nintendo following the Direct. So we've all watched it and we thought we'd talk about it now. I guess for me, to start things off, I'm going to talk about Fire Emblem Warriors because I have opinions about this game. In theory, it's something that I should absolutely love. I love Fire Emblem. It's my favorite Nintendo franchise. I love Koei Tecmo and the Warriors, what they do with the Warriors series there. But something about Fire Emblem Warriors is not gelling with me at all. And the more I see of it, the less it's gelling with me. So I guess for me, the biggest issue, I will say the biggest issue for me up front is that there's no Lin. Lin being the most popular Fire Emblem character of all. And this is a game that pulls together, you know, characters from, you know, various Fire Emblem games. They didn't seem fit to put Lin in there. So that's stroke number one. But more generally speaking, the thing that's concerning me a little bit about Fire Emblem Warriors is that there's no real distinct sense of place about it. It's got a new narrative and it's got new lead characters, which are new to the franchise, and that's fine. But one of the things that was great about Hyrule Warriors was that it took the kind of the lore and the settings and the environments and the backstory of the Hyrule games and really ran with it. So, you know, fighting in a Dynasty Warriors kind of game within the castle, the Hyrule castle was a great experience. Fire Emblem doesn't seem to have that sense. It seems to be a more generic kind of fantasy world at the moment. And there isn't that sense of place. There isn't that sense of setting. Yes, it's got some of the characters, but we don't know if they're going to be properly fleshed out or what they're going to do. And to me, it seems like, I mean, there's plenty of Warriors games that do that already, like Arslan. The Warriors of Legend has a very similar setup to what this Warriors game looks like it's going to offer. And if it is going to be that kind of generic experience, and I'm not going to get that sense of Fire Emblem through it, I'm going to be pretty disappointed with it. So, yeah, that's the simple way to fix that, of course, is just put Lin in the bloody game, Nintendo.
It can be DLC.
No, it has to be a proper character with proper narrative.
She needs to be...
Not just a character. Not exactly. Just a, you know,
like, I mean, all the material that we've seen so far, actually, surprisingly enough, has, well, I guess surprising for me personally, but maybe not surprising commercially, is that all the material that we've seen so far has been using characters that are newer to the franchise, which I understand from a commercial standpoint because these are the games that you've sold, you know, most recently, and you're trying to cater to a lot of new fans. But I think with the Musou title like this, I don't think people that have just started getting to the franchise will want to buy it or feel the need to buy it because it draws in so many characters which they may have never actually seen before. I think all the promo materials just showing, you know, the new characters and the incredibly bland twins who get too much screen time for this new world. I think that's a huge mistake.
Apparently, Jenny, the game is only pulling characters from three games. From what I've heard, apparently it's only pulling games from Shadow Dragon, which is the first one with Marth and stuff. And fair enough. And then also Fates and Birthright, I believe.
Oh.
I believe the main cast is being drawn from those three games, which is probably the worst three games you can possibly choose.
Yeah.
You can argue Shadow Dragon has the heritage, I guess, because Marth is the first. But I can't believe that they left the two Game Boy Advance games off.
I know, Sacred Stones. I think the cast from Sacred Stones was amazing. And they are too far behind on the fan favorite list either.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're going to put a pair of twins in, pulling the twins from Sacred Stones would have made more sense to me.
That's only two games that you mentioned.
Shadow Dragon, Birthright, and Fates. Oh, yeah, that's right.
Birthright is one of the...
Sorry.
I think it's going to be Awakening.
Awakening and Fates. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. The two of the 3DS ones, not the recent one, Echoes. So not Echoes, but the other two. And then Shadow Dragon. Yeah.
Yes, that means Chrome will be in it. Yay!
Yeah, Chrome's in. We've already seen him. Yeah. We've already seen him. His skinny arms and all.
We've seen him with his, like, one, his, like, off-the-shoulder man singlet. thing.
It's so hard.
It's very practical, of course, in combat against fully armored units. But
Which one of those games is Lynn in, Matt?
She's in the first GBA one. I don't know. Sacred Stones, is that what it's? No.
It's the Blazing Blade.
The Blazing Blade. In the West, it's only called Fire Emblem because it was the first Fire Emblem in English. But yeah, the Burning Blade is the Japanese subtitle for it. That's got the best cast of all the Fire Emblems as far as I'm concerned. Nintendo chose the very best the series has ever put out to be the first Western Fire Emblem game. And then they just, it's not just Lynn. Lynn's great, but it's also got, Hector.
And Kaelin and Ellie Wood as well.
Yeah, and it's got Matthew the thief, who's just all kinds of cool. It's got what's her name, the Pegasus Knight that scared him in. She's so cute. I can't remember her name now. Anyway, she's great. It's just got a great cast in general. Urk the wizard, they should have pulled some. That should have been one of the three games they pulled characters from, because it's got such a great cast. Okay, but anyway, that wasn't the only Nintendo game that we saw at E3 this year. There was a lot of great stuff, and I think probably the best man to talk us through how much we should be getting excited for stuff is Trent, the resident Nintendo fan boy. So, Trent, take it away. What did you really like from the show?
All right, from the showcase itself, like the direct part, the only two games I actually remember which was shown off during that, Yoshi and Kirby.
Yay.
I do not remember anything else from that direct, and I'm still waking up at 2 a.m. since. Those two games are really, really solid. Like, I can't wait to, play the Yoshi game. I think that was that revealed last year, or am I just misremembering? Because were they discussing that sort of technique with the...
They've had the yarn type thing. Like, I think they made like a Kirby's Woolly World or something, another like Woolly World game last year, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, but what I mean is that technique where it's the cardboard cutouts. I think they were discussing that last year, were they? Or
yeah, I don't think it was ever announced that it was a Yoshi game. This is the first I've seen of it being Yoshi, which is great. The last Yoshi and the 3DS of that as well were particularly good platformers, so more Yoshi is good.
Yeah, definitely, and more Kirby as well. I think Kirby's got a great chance to be a really good franchise. A lot of people probably have forgotten the earlier Kirby games, and it's going to be, if they play their cards right, it could be a big franchise like Fire Emblem starting to be coming again. It's sort of had a small few releases in the Western area, not many people remember it. It could really come back with a big resurgence in, if they play their cards right for Kirby. So both those two games I'm really excited for. But then you've got the traditional ones like, Mario Odyssey. Everyone's already talked about that. Everyone's still talking about that. It's going to be a big player. It's probably, in terms of Nintendo games, up there next to Zelda as being Game of the Year. It's going to be a really close one between those two games because they're both pushing both franchises really well and into new directions. And I think that cap which Mario has, it's crazy to think what it could possess and how that technique works. Because in the trailer, we've seen dinosaurs being possessed, we've seen random people. And I think there was an interview at some point where it's like, why have you decided to choose this, new Donkey Kong City or whatever it's called as the setting place? And it's like, well, essentially, it's random. It makes no sense. That's why we picked it. And I think there's going to be some great experiences because of that from the series. So,
The other one we obviously have to mention is Metroid. People have been looking for new Metroid games for the longest time now. And Nintendo has been trolling every fan with stuff like Federation Force. The confirmation that there's going to be two Metroid games, or there are two Metroid games in the works at the moment. There's a 3DS remake of Metroid 2, which was the Game Boy original. And then there's also a Metroid Prime 4 for people who like the more modern approach to Metroid. I'm not the world's biggest fan of Metroid. I don't seem to understand why people love it, but people do, so good on them, and I'm glad that Nintendo's giving them stuff. The only thing I will say is Metroid 2 should be, the remake of Metroid 2 should be approached with a big bag of salt, because the developer that's been contracted to do that one is Mercury Steam. Mercury Steam is best known as the company that finally put the final nail in the coffin for Castlevania by absolutely ruining that franchise. So they don't really understand the heritage of the games that they're working on. I have absolutely no faith in that developer to be able to do Metroid any better justice, to be honest. As brutal as that sounds, but they're not good.
I will second that opinion as a big Metroid fan. From the trailer, it just kind of looks like, well, there's a lot of problems for it, but the first one is that it's lost that sort of definitive Metroid look and feel to some extent, and they've gone for a more kind of generic sort of 3D look, a bit like what happened with the 3DS Castlevania, whatever that was called.
Nero of Fate or whatever it was.
Yeah, it's kind of lost that art style a bit, and I think that's the one problem. And the other big problem I have with it is that they have decided that it needs to have a free aim system thing where you can use the analog stick to freely aim. And Matt laughs because I've been ranting about this and Slack and on Twitter for like the last week, because it seems like a very small thing, but it's as a side effect of having that free aim system, it means that presumably you have to play with the analog stick instead of the directional pad, and the 3DS has a really, really bad analog stick, especially for 2D games. And that was actually that Castlevania Mirror of Fate or whatever it was called, that was had the same thing, and that didn't have a free aim. It was just a design feature that you could only use the analog stick while the directional pad buttons went unused. And it just meant that you couldn't play for, or I couldn't play for more than about 20 minutes, half an hour without my hand cramping up. And yes, I just don't. It's going to be a lot harder to like that Metroid 2 remake, then it should be.
If there's anything good which can come out from it, is the fact that that Metroid amiibo exists with the little squishy amiibo on it. I think that's probably the only good thing to come out so far from that game's reveal.
I mean, the amiibos look pretty good. There's a Princess Peach bridal gown amiibo thing, and that's really great. I mean, would have been great better if it was Link bridal gown amiibo, but you know.
They already put her in Fire Emblem Heroes. I don't think they're going to make an amiibo of her in a bridal gown.
Yeah. Well, yeah, maybe as DLC for Fire Emblem Warriors. I guess that's what we can hope for. But, yeah, I mean, there was other bits and pieces. We should talk briefly about Rabbids, because Rabbids looks really bloody good. I don't think anybody, well, Trent was already talking about it being Game of the Year and all that stuff, and I think he was perhaps joking a little bit, but he might not be as far off the mark as he was saying. It looks really, really bloody good. It's we were all there watching the Ubisoft show where it was first showed off, and we were like, hang on, this is like XCOM. But with Mario and Rabbids, and what the hell is going on? And once we got over that initial confusion, we realized, hey, this is a game we all kind of really want to play. So, yeah, there wasn't too much third-party stuff that Nintendo has on the Switch. There was a lot being said about Skyrim nonsense. But other than that, Nintendo hasn't done a great job yet of engaging with third parties with the Switch, and fair enough, it'll take a while for them to get over the Wii U disaster. But, you know, that game shows that there's potential there for third parties to really kind of work with Nintendo and do some interesting stuff.
Yeah, so Rabbids definitely looks like a solid game. I like when the initial reveal of that, you know, it's obviously, you know, them usually jumping around, you know, everyone hates them, and then all of a sudden, XCOM game. So that was like a really big turnaround during the reveal, which people were suddenly like, hang on a minute, this looks great. The other thing was I really enjoyed how the lead developer was very emotional when that game was shown off, because, you know, if you had a game where you worked, you know, what was it, 4 years, I think it was said that they've been working on it to make a game with Nintendo, and the whole internet is basically bagging it out, you know, it's going to be bad, you know, it's got these characters which we don't like, you know, that sort of stuff, and then all of a sudden everyone's enjoying it. I think you would be very emotional as well to see that on stage and received as well as it did during that initial reveal. So it was, you know, really good to see. Ubisoft excels really well at showing the raw emotion of their developers, and I really like that from them as a publisher. So I ended up watching a bit more of the Treehouse had a bit more footage of the game, and they were explaining a few of the techniques and how you can jump over water and, you know, how the mechanics sort of work. And it seems like it's going to be really, you know, it doesn't, you know, a lot of the Rabbit games in the past, they've been, you know, really easy, you know, this looks like it will be in some ways, but it looks like you can also have a lot of thought and, you know, decision making behind any, you know, tactical decisions to advance through the levels. So, you know, I'm really excited for the game, and I've already got the collector's edition pre-ordered, so
Yeah, and it's nice to see Nintendo, you know, really offering its most, you know, valuable franchise, which is Mario, to third-party developers. You know, we know that Nintendo's been pretty good at working with Japanese publishers and developers in the past. You know, they've done great collaboration stuff with Square Enix and with Koei and Capcom, but they haven't had such a great track record in working with third parties in the West. Ubisoft is probably the most Nintendo friendly of the major publishers, must be said. I can't see EA and Activision jumping on board to do like a Battlefront Mario edition anytime soon. But you know, it's nice to know that Nintendo is there and willing to work with Western developers to, you know, bring their major franchises into you know, a different kind of development environment. So that's exciting to see. That's, you know, potentially a good thing for the Switch in the future as well.
Well, a lot of games have been since revealed by some Japanese developers since E3, saying, you know, we're working on Switch, there's going to be our games on the Switch. So it's great to see that support, even though it's not an official E3 game, you know, seeing people talking about it and showing it out after that. So I think the Switch will progress into a really great console.
Yeah, and just quickly on that, I did want to mention that one of the games that you're talking about there, the developer of Voez, which is one of the best Switch games that's on the console at the moment. It's a rhythm game. It's really, really cool, very stylish, very cool actually. The developer of that game has a premium Diablo style RPG on the mobile platforms. They're bringing that to Switch, which would be really cool. Yeah. It'll be cheap. It'll be $15. Yeah, that's premium by mobile standards. Cheap for a Switch game, but it looks really good. If you have a look at the footage of the game in action, it's something to get really excited for, I think. welcome back again. So you might have seen through the podcast so far, we've got a theme going with our music. This week, it's all about Final Fantasy XIV music, and there's a reason for that. The new expansion for Final Fantasy XIV, the new major expansion for Final Fantasy XIV, comes out very soon, and people are now getting on the early access and giving it a go. And you know, this new expansion adds a new storyline, it needs a whole lot more, I hate saying the word, but adds a whole lot more content into the game. You know, people who have already spent months and months of their lives playing Final Fantasy XIV now have an excuse to play for even more months, and that's a great thing. This is definitely an MMO that people who don't usually play MMOs are loving, that me being one of them. I would never have touched Warcraft, but I think my time log in Final Fantasy XIV is now at about 3 weeks in total playtime. And I'm still not quite up to the point where I'm actually ready to get into this expansion. So that's how big this game is, and it's just about to get even bigger. And who else is excited? I know Matt is very excited for this. So, Matt.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited.
Pretty excited. He's been asking like for a code to review it for months now, so...
it's it looks good. I'm so excited that I don't even know what to say. There's a bunch of new zones that look really cool, as part of the story takes the characters to new places inspired by Japan and kind of Asia in general. I don't think it's just Japan. I think there's some Chinese inspiration in there as well. And along with that, there's a new samurai job, which would be a lot of fun. Which is, I'm still a little bit torn because I think I wanted, in Final Fantasy XI, the samurai job was a tank class. And
yeah.
I kind of wanted that to be the same here, just because tanks are more fun. I want to play a samurai, but tanks are more fun than damage dealers. So, but I'll still play a samurai and have a lot of fun. Otherwise, yeah, swimming would be cool. I'm glad to see that they've added, it's not just the new areas where you can go swimming, but they've some areas that already have been around since the start, like Costa del Sol, you can go swimming in, which you would hope so, because that place has always been
full of
designed
water
as a kind of beach from day one. So
full of water. Yes.
Well, I mean, there's lots of places in the game are full of water, but that is a swimming water. It's a beach resort. There are there's lots of water in the game that you wouldn't want to swim in, but you probably will have to.
Just needs a beach volleyball mechanic now. Mini game.
It really does. Mm-hmm. I'm sure they'll add
out on that. That's a big opportunity.
But
yeah, I mean, it looks great.
Yeah, there's a lot of mechanical changes to the way jobs work and all that kind of stuff. So it'll be interesting to see, to pick those all.
It'll be interesting to see if the game starts to. I mean, it was already, you know, tough for new players to get into. It'll be interesting to see if it becomes even more intimidating for new players, and whether, you know, the earlier areas in the game where you know, if you're to start playing now and need to work through those dungeons and those storylines, whether it's going to be possible to even get the group together to do it. I mean, Final Fantasy XIV has always tried to encourage people to go back and help others with the earlier dungeons, but it's still difficult. With some of them to get a group together, and hopefully that's something they address, because this is such a major expansion and it's going to get so much press and it's going to get so much attention, it might, you know, encourage people to give it a go for the first time
and yeah, see what I think
about it. And I'd hate for them to feel like they're not welcome because everybody's just playing the new expansion content.
Well, I think I think in a way the fact that you can now actually, if I'm not wrong, you can actually purchase a level boost or a booster character, I suppose, that starts up quite close to end level, like similar like what WoW did when Activision took over. and they sort of made it easy for people to sort of start and join the Endgame community, despite, you know, not having played the game from the start, having to skip all the sort of, I suppose, the grinding and the woeful trek from getting from level 40 to level 60, which haunts me to this day.
But, I mean, that's one thing. I don't know. Like, in the narrative of Final Fantasy XIV is a bigger role than I think the narrative is in World of Warcraft. I don't know. It's not a great narrative by any means, but yeah, you know, it's enough to put context into the world and get you kind of involved with what's going on. And if you can just skip past all of that and get to the Stormblood content, then that's missing a big part of what the game offers. So I don't think that's the right solution if that is the only solution that Square Enix is relying on.
Yeah, for sure. And I think as well, when you have that solution combining with the fact that the two new jobs are both DPS jobs, like, queuing for endgame content is going to be a crap fest. Like, if everyone's sort of like, you know, people that use the game want to start and then they boost the character up and then they play two DPS classes, that is going to be a nightmare for people like Matt and myself who heal and tank. And I just feel like, especially with, and then I think combining those issues or that set of issues that you get with new players, DPS classes that might also as well not be very beginner friendly compared to the original classes. And then also having issues whereby healing's been like completely rejigged for classes like White Mage now. And now that they've just done all these changes to the different, I guess, like DPS healing and tanking, how they've got sort of those core skills now and lots of the utility has been shuffled around. I think that there'll be lots of familiarizing to do, both for old and new players. I think that will
I mean, for the other thing for new players, and this is an issue that I've had with MMOs in general, but yeah, new players might not know what DPS and tanking and healing and all that stuff means, let alone what they're meant to do with it all. So again, I think the story in Final Fantasy XIV did a good job in easing people into that kind of MMO style of gameplay. And if they feel like they have to buy these potions that let them leapfrog through all of that stuff, they're going to be absolutely lost come to, you know, the Stormblood campaign and content. So again, this is not a solution I hope that Square Enix is relying on getting people into the game and, you know, encouraging new players.
Yeah, I think it's... I agree. I think skipping all that story content is kind of missing a big part of the game, and because it is a lot more of a story focused game than most MMOs, and it has a much better story. I think it is, I would disagree with you, Matt. I think it is a great story, and it's just kind of more,
I only mean not great compared to some of the other Final Fantasies, not you know, compared to other MMOs. It is better than most MMOs.
Yeah, yeah. And but I think it is like kind of on the level of a lot of, and by design it throws back a lot to like kind of the in terms of the way it, the story itself and the way it's told and the kind of plot beats and stuff, it throws back a lot to like the SNES games and like Final Fantasy 4, 5, 6, and so I think it is a good story, and if you go and buy the level boost, you're going to miss all, out on all of that. I think one thing that I do like about it, and I assume this will continue through Stormblood, is that Square has been really good at finding ways to not just encourage high-level players to help new players, but to actually incentivize that. So you've got stuff like the Judy roulettes, where as a way, as one of the new ways of collecting you need for to get the best gear in the game, there are a lot of ways to do that, but among them is being a roulette where, which just like slots you into a random dungeon where there's a space for whatever role you are, and so that's a good way of getting high level players to keep doing those low level dungeons even right from like the very first one, in a way that they're not just there for being a good Samaritan, and it's not just relying on people being good Samaritans.
They get something great.
And that's one example, but there have been other things that they've added in across the life of Heaven's Ward to encourage that kind of stuff, and so I assume we'll see more of that. So hopefully new players who decide to start now won't be too intimidated.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, if nothing else, the new players who decide to start now might enjoy the greatly expanded number of costumes. And I did want to talk about that because everybody loves playing dress up with their MMO characters. They spend so yep. bloody long with them that they're more or less like a significant other. you know, three weeks of my life spent with my character. Just as well, she's gorgeous. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of new costumes that have been added into the game, which is just great. You've got the more standard costumes, but you know, some of the stuff that we've seen, I think Matt can talk to this because I can only remember a couple of them. But yeah, they've got some wild and some very entertaining costumes and some kind of fan service-y ones, for lack of a better word. There's swimsuits, which are great. There's school uniforms, which are great. And there's Cheongsams, which is a Chinese dress, which is great. And whatever else that I can't remember, but Matt will fill us in there.
It was, well, at the... In a couple of days ago during E3, one of the Square Enix streams, they had a Final Fantasy 14 bit to talk about some of the new stuff. And during that, they had like a, I guess, a show reel of a bunch of the new gear that you'll be available. And some of it is just the usual kind of high level, get some cool armor. But then there's a lot of more, I guess, costumey stuff that you can use to glamour onto your actual armor to make it look better. And among that, it seems like there's, and I mean, they have done this kind of stuff before, but there's, as part of that show reel, there was a bunch of different, I guess, kind of outfits inspired by different cultures around the world. And so there was the Cheongsam. And there was like something that looked like kind of Tibetan type of gear. There was,
oh yeah, that one was good. I like that.
A lumberjack outfit.
Yeah.
And the school uniform was in there. There was some like Middle Eastern kind of stuff. And other silly things. There was a like intentionally like looked like it designed to look really sloppily home crafted like pig costume, like some really bad homemade cosplay that you want to dress as,
oh my gosh,
a pig. And there is, it might be quite hard to get because apparently this is going to be one of the rewards for the new 8-player raid, but for fans of Final Fantasy will enjoy that getting Genji armor.
Yes.
Which has been for a long, since about FF5, I think.
Because, I mean, that's one of the things that's always interested me about Final Fantasy 14. It's always been so much about the quest scene and the dungeons and all of that, that, you know, there doesn't seem to have been the same emphasis on, you know, kind of having fun with costumes. And I mean, there's been some of that, and there's been certainly, you know, kind of Easter events or Christmas inspired events and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, I've always wanted, you know, stuff in Final Fantasy 14 that doesn't have to do with, doesn't have directly to do with the main questing or the combat system and stuff like that. And you know, costumes are one thing. I'd like to see more stuff added to Final Fantasy 14 around, yeah, Chocobo Racing or whatever, yeah. To really start to build out, you know, a culture within the game that is, you can just kind of go in there and live in the world rather than just play a game as such. There is Chocobo Racing now, I know, but when Final Fantasy 14 started, for the longest time, there wasn't, and we were waiting for it. And it'd be like, you know, it'd be nice to see it expanded out and added, you know, more stuff added into it and, you know, just more generally, I'd like to see if I can have a wish list for stuff beyond Stormblood. It'd just be to build out not so much the narrative stuff now, because I think between the three campaigns, between the main game, Heavensward, and now Stormblood, there's enough of that to spend literally, you know, months of time playing. It'd be nice to have, you know, a broader range of activities to do in the game, I think.
Yeah, I hope we'll see more of that as well. I assume we will, but time will tell, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we can definitely assume that it'll happen because Square Enix is definitely working hard to make this game worth a subscription fee at a time where MMOs are definitely moving away from that kind of payment model. Yeah. I don't think there's any left. It's like, what, Warcraft at Final Fantasy 14 and everything else is now free to play?
Well, Warcraft has a mechanic now where you can pay for your subscription with in-game currency.
Mm. Oh, do they?
Yeah. So they've had it for a while now, and so basically, if you earn enough in-game currency, and it's not like a very difficult amount to earn if you play, I don't know, like if you do your professions and their max level, and you sell some stuff in the auction house, it's not hard to amass the money. So they made it actually quite easy for people to actually pay for their subscriptions with in-game currency without sort of like ruining the auction house, which was a lot of people's worry when that mechanic first came out. So it could be interesting.
Yeah. So if you have a lot of real money and you just want some gold, instead of going to like an illegal gold farmer, you can just buy some subscriptions and put them up on the auction house.
Yeah.
Fun thing of that, I don't know exactly how it works, but you can use that to get, not just for World of Warcraft, but to get credit for like the Blizzard Battle.net store. And so you can buy like Hearthstone packs or things. And there was a weird thing recently when Destiny 2 pre-orders opened where people were using their gold from World of Warcraft to buy credit to pre-order Destiny 2.
Oh my god.
Of
all the games, Destiny 2.
Yeah.
Like Destiny wasn't enough. You had to go and make another one.
There's going to be three of them. But yeah, I mean, I guess that's kind of indicative that, you know, people are less willing to even pay, you know, for World of Warcraft now. So Square Enix certainly has to work hard to make sure that they can continue to charge a monthly fee for access to Final Fantasy 14. I think, you know, I do think that what's there is certainly worth it.
Sure.
And it just matters. It's just a matter of being able to continually develop on this kind of cycle that they've got going. Because it's a major release every year, isn't it? That
they've got planned.
Yeah.
Every 2 years. 2 years since Heaven's World. 2 years since Heaven's World, was it?
Yeah.
Yep.
2 years ago. Wow.
I think one thing that they could add in Stormblood, which would, especially with swimming, it seems like a natural fit, as well as beach volleyball. They need to add a Blitzball mini game.
Yeah, I think they were actually talking about that. Like, I read somewhere that they were talking about adding Blitzball or incorporating Blitzball in some way in Stormblood, but they hadn't quite figured out how yet. So maybe if we're loud enough, they might patch it out after the first Razor release. So we can work on some tension.
The mini games from the various Final Fantasy games is certainly a good place they can go for that stuff. Yeah. I'm pretty sure Triple Triad's already in there, isn't there?
It is, yeah.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. But what about, you know, they could set up like an arcade where you go and play the Final Fantasy 15 pinball minigame and have, you know, online competitions for that kind of stuff. And that Blitzball would be another one. Beach volleyball would be a good example. Yeah, that kind of extra content just to keep people, you know, playing and doing stuff that isn't involved with the main quest.
Do you know that Lord of Vermillion game that Square Enix published? It might just be over in Japan. They've got like a minigame based on that that you can play in the Gold Saucer.
Yeah.
Oh, do they?
It's like a little, like, real
time. It's like a casino.
Nice.
Yeah.
This is all good stuff. this stuff actually excites me more than, I guess, the main Stormblood narrative, which will be great, I'm sure. But, yeah, you know, when I play an MMO, I just kind of want to exist in a world as much as anything else. And, you need to be able to do stuff that doesn't just involve killing stuff to be able to enjoy that.